From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a new state law means a chance at money for people wrongfully convicted of a crime.
It allows them to maybe put their lives back together, maybe get an education that was missed because they spent those years in prison, maybe get a place to live.
The Michigan housewife at the heart of the famous Burning Bed case that woke America up to domestic abuse.
It served as a catalyst for people to see how this can happen and how it can escalate, and it really spurred more programs, more shelters, more volunteerism, more attention to this issue.
And the song that crowns the March Madness born while talking to a waitress at an East Lansing bar.
I tried to explain to her the poetry of basketball, and she was not interested, but I got an idea for a song.
But first, the news. Up until now, if you were unjustly sent to prison in Michigan and then exonerated, you got nothing. But that has changed.
It allows them to maybe put their lives back together, maybe get an education that was missed because they spent those years in prison, maybe get a place to live.
I'm Cynthia Canty. That story coming up on today's program. But first, the tweet came in at 12:33 p.m. last Saturday. At Real Donald Trump is bringing auto plants and jobs back to Michigan. At Justin Amash is a big liability. Hashtag Trump train, defeat him in primary. Justin Amash is, of course, the congressman from the 3rd District in West Michigan. And the tweet? It came from Dan Scavino, Jr., a senior advisor to President Donald Trump. Instantly, critics pounced, accusing Scavino of violating the Hatch Act, a vintage law dating back to the Depression. Some called for him to be fired. Let's dig into this and learn about the Hatch Act. Stephen Vladeck is with us, a law professor at the University of Texas. He's also a Supreme Court analyst for CNN. Stephen, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What is the Hatch Act?
So the Hatch Act is actually a pretty old statute. As you say, it dates back to the Depression. It was enacted in 1939, although it actually replaced an executive order that had been first put out in 1907. And it's basically a law that prohibits federal government employees from actively engaging in what the statute calls political activities, basically in taking public positions on who should run for office, on who should win elections, on other matters of sort of partisan political preferences. It's designed basically to ensure that lower-level government employees don't feel pressured by their superiors to engage in partisan political activity and to avoid the appearance of corruption. That is to say that government employees might be using their offices to advance other people's political and partisan ends.
And this law covers, what, all civilian executive branch employees except for?
Except for the president and the vice president. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with the president of the United States getting on a plane and going and campaigning on behalf of, say, you know, the next potential nominee in his party. The problem is that when you have senior White House employees actively taking to Twitter to either support or oppose current members of Congress and to literally say, you know, vote for somebody else, that seems to be exactly what the Hatch Act is worried about.
When you saw that tweet, Steve, did you think that violated the Hatch Act?
I did. I mean, I will say, you know, I think it's hard to keep score and to keep track of all of the ways in which communications from this White House are running afoul of either the Hatch Act or other various federal, you know, statutory disclosure rules. But it's especially important for someone in Mr. Scavino's position. I mean, part of his job is public relations and communications. Those are the very people who should know exactly where the line is between what federal employees are allowed to say about future elections and about current members of Congress, and what they're not allowed to say, at least in their official capacity.
Indeed, I believe he's director of social media for the president and for the White House. So he's in his bailiwick.
One would think. I mean, now there are, I should be clear, I mean, there are some exceptions in the Hatch Act. I mean, there are some, you know, special rules that allow, for example, folks to support their bosses if their bosses are engaging in lawful activity. So if I'm an assistant to a senior executive branch official who's allowed to make some kind of statement or some kind of communication and I go with him, I'm covered because I'm on duty. The problem here is that the entire substance of the communication in this case seems to be a politically motivated attack on a sitting member of Congress and an encouragement for someone to run against him, presumably in the 2018 primary. That's the exact kind of activity by the exact kind of person that the Hatch Act was always intended to prohibit.
So let's say Dan Scavino Jr. wants to express his displeasure with Congressman Amash. Could he have done that without this Hatch Act mess?
Yeah, I mean, there are ways to do it. So the Hatch Act does distinguish between things you're doing as part of your day job and things you do in your private capacity. This is why, For example, a lot of government employees have both professional and private email accounts. The rules are different as to those. You know, if Dan Scavino had a private Twitter account where it was clear that he was not tweeting in his capacity as the director of social media for the White House, and in that capacity, and let's just say after hours to make it even clearer, he said, listen, just on my own, not speaking in any official capacity, you know, this is how I feel about Justin Amash, that would be a much harder case. I mean, I think you'd still have folks complaining. But man, what he actually did is so much closer to the heart of the statute that, you know, I think that that hard case is not this one.
Is there some question whether he was doing it officially or from his own private account?
Yeah, but I mean, the problem is with social media, right? When you have a social media profile that identifies you as, you know, the director of social media for the White House, not clear where the line is between public and private. And this is part of why the, you know, internal executive branch agency responsible for HATCH Act compliance, called the Office of the Special Counsel, has actually put out specific guidance to executive branch employees about social media, where they've basically said, listen, you have to be extra careful in this context where folks could very well confuse private capacity statements with official capacity statements. Certainly looks like the tweet from Scavino comes pretty close to the official side of that line.
Stephen, what's the big picture here? Why is it we should care about whether one White House aide broke an old law?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a good question. And the reality is the fact that one White House aide, you know, may have broken this old law, which, by the way, isn't even a criminal statute. I mean, the principal remedies for violations of the Hatch Act are some kind of administrative discipline. I think the larger point is the larger pattern that we're seeing, especially in this White House, of either, you know, negligent or reckless or intentional disregard for a whole bunch of federal ethics and conflict of interest rules that are designed to keep people basically within their lines. They're designed to avoid the appearance of partiality. They're designed to avoid the notion that actions are being taken not for policy reasons but for purely political reasons. You know, these statutes exist for a reason, and the more that we see instances where it looks like different White House employees are crossing these lines, you know, the more I think everyone, Democratic, Republican, whatever, should be worried about the compliance here and should be worried about the implications of a White House that seems just so carefree about these ethical rules.
Stephen Vladeck is a law professor at the University of Texas. Thank you so much, Steve.
Thank you.
Collaboration.
Innovation.
The next idea.
The world doesn't stop. The world continues to change. So we as people need to change along with it.
One top priority of the Trump administration is rolling back the Dodd-Frank Act and other financial regulations. The next idea is Jeff DeGraff thinks that could be dangerous, but so could some up-and-coming financial tools that might be as disruptive as they are useful.
A few years before the Great Recession, I was an advisor to the Federal Reserve Bank. I provided some limited advice on how to stimulate growth through innovation. It was too little, too late. Many financial experts far more capable than myself tried to help prevent the imminent collapse. But the politicians were sure they knew more about the economic system than the experts. Hindsight proves they knew very little, and it was the everyday American who suffered from their ignorance and arrogance. So here we are again. Less than a decade away from our brush with economic Armageddon, we are deregulating the financial industry. We don't need the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act because the same financial institutions that were too big to fail but required trillions of dollars to bail out will apparently regulate and police themselves. It's like returning to the honor system when half the class was caught cheating and still failed the exam. On top of that, the big investment banks have now invented something called spread networks. Author Michael Lewis brought these to light via his bestseller, Flash Boys. Basically, these networks give big banks an advantage by executing trades faster than everyone else, allowing them to buy lower and sell higher than the average Joe. While these spread networks game the system that the banks themselves created, the bigger problem is that they trip trading algorithms in other financial institutions. Forget irrational exuberance. This is artificial exuberance. These systems are not responding to market dynamics. They are creating them. Ironically, investment banking itself was created from the outside in. In the 18th century, inherited property was the only pathway to wealth. Mayer Amschel Rothschild, a Jew from Frankfurt, helped create many of the financial innovations we still recognize today, global banking, bond markets, foreign exchange and arbitrage. Rothschild, who endured pogroms and daily doses of anti-Semitism, developed imaginative ways to infiltrate a system designed to keep people like him out. Today, the biggest innovations in finance are largely happening outside the financial community as well. Digital cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin are emerging as viable financial alternatives. They're basically managed via a continuously growing distributed database called a blockchain. All users have a record of all transactions all the time, which means no hidden fees, accounting errors, or hacked accounts. In other words, no bank needed. Innovations like Bitcoin can disrupt more than just financial institutions. They can move independently of borders and the laws that govern nations. They can be used for illicit purposes without detection. Most importantly, since government has no line of sight, collecting tax on these transactions is almost impossible. More and more digital innovations are being used to bypass ATM fees, deflect overage charges, and switch credit card debt to lower-cost alternatives. They provide lending networks that are an affordable substitute to predatory payday loans, as well as algorithms that predict the creditworthiness of people with no credit history. And these are just the beginning. In the near future, artificial intelligence software, along with open and pervasive internet access, will make it easier to disintermediate the big banks. The ability to connect lenders with borrowers, manage complex corporate transactions like mergers, and invest capital productively will no longer be the monopoly of the banks. While our largest financial institutions are lobbying to recover the freedoms they enjoyed before they destroyed the economy a decade ago, entrepreneurs are innovating their way around them, creating a financial future that will make banks more and more irrelevant. Which makes one wonder if someday we'll hear the phrase, too slow to fail.
Jeff DeGraff is a professor at the University of Michigan and our partner in The Next Idea. You'll find his essay at the Next Idea link at michiganradio.org.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Up next, Michigan composer David Barrett talks about writing what the Wall Street Journal has dubbed the most famous song in sports. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's the cherry on top of the sundae that is March Madness.
The ball is two, and there you are. You're running for your life. You're a shooting star. And all the years, no one knows just how hard you worked. But now it shows in one shining.
When either Gonzaga or North Carolina emerges victorious tonight, one shining moment will be played to close the coverage of March Madness, as it's been since 1987. The Wall Street Journal calls it the most famous song in sports. And there's a nice big Michigan tie to this tradition. One Shining Moment was written by Michigander David Barrett, singer, songwriter, Emmy-winning composer, who is with us now. David, welcome.
Hi, Cindy.
So
glad to be here.
Glad to have you here. Did I get this right? You were sitting in a bar in East Lansing in 1986 watching TV?
That is utterly and absolutely true. Yes, I was gazing up, watching Larry Bird play at the end of an evening of performing, and bar had cleared. The most beautiful waitress in the Midwest sat down next to me. I panicked. I tried to explain to her the poetry of basketball, and she was not interested, but I got an idea for a song.
And what was that idea? What inspired you?
Well, I was watching Larry Bird play, and he was, of course, in his prime, and I was trying to explain to this young lady that, you know, he was uniquely skilled in ways that he was, what's in basketball terms, in the zone, particularly in that phase of his career, and trying to describe that sort of transcendence that he was enjoying at the time. And I thought, boy, he's right where everyone who plays sports wants to be. And And then it occurred to me, I just had a pen and jotted down on a napkin, one shining moment.
When and where did you actually write the song, and how easily did it come?
Well, it came really easy. I went home, went to bed with this napkin in my pocket, and I went to the Nightcap 2 for breakfast with a friend who showed up 20 minutes late, which he continues to remind me of. And I wrote all the lyrics on another napkin, so I had two napkins, and went home from breakfast and wrote it in 20 minutes.
And home was Hazlitt, right?
Hazlitt, yes.
So you were sitting at your piano and you knocked out this song. How did it wind up getting into the hands of CBS Sports?
Well, I had a friend, dear friend. His name's Armin Katayan. He now works for 60 Minutes, but at the time he was writing for Sports Illustrated. And I was in New York that summer prior, and I had written a song, and I stayed with Armin, and we were watching basketball, of course, and I said, Armin, I wrote a pretty good song about basketball. And he said, well, if you ever record it, send it to me. In the fall, got around to recording it, sent it on a cassette. That's when we had cassettes. In the U.S. mail to him. And unbeknownst to me, he took it over to CBS. So they called out of the blue, which I thought it was one of my knucklehead friends putting me on, but it turns out it was actually CBS. Next thing you know, here we are talking.
And I checked out your website, and I know you had your moment of hoops glory playing for Bloomfield Hills and over against Clarkston High School. You had 32 points.
I was a ball hog. I always felt I was open no matter what. Just give me the ball, I'll just fire it.
Now, I know you've gone on to compose a heap of themes and scores for television. So was one shining moment the Cinderella carriage that got you to the ball?
Oh, absolutely. After that, I magically became talented. And actually, I'd been writing for many, many years. But this was a portal that, you know, many of those compositions ended up on the Olympics, you know, all sorts of themes. Some of them found their way into some scoring I've done. So all of a sudden, the other work that I had written became valuable.
When you watch the Final Four and then that montage plays at the end, and I know I love that. It takes you through all of March Madness. I know they're working furiously to lay in those final shots. But what is it about hearing your song at that kind of penultimate moment of March Madness? What does that feel like?
Well, I obviously am grateful. The first time it played in 87, a friend of mine at CBS named Doug Tuohy, it's really his vision. He understood the poetry of sports. The first time I thought, because I had no idea how they were going to use it, and I thought, oh, my goodness, they got it. They got it right. And so every year, you know, to see how much this means to all these players from Utah to Brooklyn to Florida to New Mexico who dream of getting to that moment, and I would say it's very, very gratifying.
David Barrett, who composed what Duke's Coach K calls the best song for any sport in the world, all written at his piano in Hazlitt, Michigan in 1986. David,
isn't that funny?
Great to talk with you. Thanks so much for spending time with us.
Thank you for having me.
When you step off the dock onto Mackinac Island, you're setting foot on land with a long and troubled history for Michigan's First People. And there are new efforts underway now to get visitors to look past the fudge shops and the quaint homes to really appreciate the Native American history on this island that they call the Great Turtle. Eric Hemingway is Director of Archives and Records for the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians. Eric, welcome back to Stateside.
Great to be back. Thank you for having me.
Tell us, how long have Native Americans been on what we now call Mackinac Island? Do we have any clear idea how far back?
Some believe that Mackinac Island is actually the genesis for the Anishinaabek, and the Anishinaabek are the Odawa, Ojibwe, and Potawatomi together. And some believe that that is where the first Anishinaabe was created. So in that sense, from the very beginning, time immemorial.
So, and extremely important then to the Anishinaabe, right?
Oh, very important. And scientific evidence has shown us people have been on the island for at least 2,000 to 3,000 years. So either way you look at it, Mackinac Island's history is very deep.
The history for these tribes on Mackinac Island took a heck of a bumpy turn once the United States government and Indian agents like Henry Schoolcraft came on the scene, didn't it?
It certainly did. And Mackinac always had a tumultuous history, even pre-contact before Europeans. And there was contests for the island when the Iroquois from the east would come and wage war against the Anishinaabek, and Mackinac would be one of these areas for contests. But yes, once the Americans came in after the War of 1812, and they were victorious in the war, they started to set some pretty hard policies towards the Anishinaabeg and other Native nations.
And the Treaty of 1836, we have got to talk about that, a prime example. Tell us first what was in it. What did Schoolcraft promise the tribes?
The Washington, D.C. Treaty of 1836 is a living document. It's still being interpreted today. The tribes had to enter into these negotiations to avoid removal. That was the policy in the 1830s and 40s. Under the Indian Removal Act created by Andrew Jackson, they wanted to remove all Indians east of the Mississippi River to west of the Mississippi River to these lands deemed Indian territory, which was Kansas and Oklahoma. And the Odawa and the Ojibwe were on the slate to be removed. The Odawa were scheduled to be removed to Kansas. No offense to anybody from Kansas listening, but we sent scouts out there, and they came back and said, no, we can't go out there. There's no water, no trees, and all of our ancestors are here in the Great Lakes.
So they say, we've got to stay here.
We have to stay here. Our livelihood is here. Our spirits are here. Our ancestors are here. Everything's here. So in order to avoid that removal, the tribes had to get into these treaties. In the Treaty of 1836, really I'm waiting for a movie to be made about this whole event because it has all the drama, characters, villains, heroes. The tribes, there's six bands, Grand River, Muskegon, Grand Traverse, Little Traverse, Mackinac, and Sault Ste. Marie, six distinct communities all come together to negotiate this treaty with the United States.
All right.
They all go to Washington, D.C. to negotiate the treaty. And earlier in 1836, the head Indian agent for the United States is a man by the name of Henry Schoolcraft. And Henry has a very convoluted, complicated history being an Indian agent in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very ambitious individual and also a very self-serving one, in my opinion. This is who the tribes have to deal with. And if they don't get into this negotiation, the alternative is removal.
Off to Kansas. So what was it that the tribes had to agree to?
Well, the tribes had to primarily cede land. That was the main focus of these treaties between the tribes and the United States. And this is the same theme throughout the United States, is acquisition of land. So the tribes had to decide how much they were going to give up and what they were going to retain once they give up this land. The Treaty of 1836 sees those six communities cede approximately 16 million acres to the United States, roughly two-thirds of the state of Michigan. So huge amount of land.
When they went to sign the treaty, they found a very interesting article in that treaty.
The treaty was negotiated in D.C., took weeks. So they ceded 16 million acres, but they got to retain lands and rights to those ceded territories. So they retained lands, which we call reservations today, but they also retain rights to hunt and gather on the ceded territory, and also monies from the land ceded. So this is what the tribes got to keep in exchange for all the land.
But there's a but coming, isn't there?
There's a big but coming. They agree to this, and Article 2 is inserted into this treaty. And Article 2 simply states, after 5 years, the president may remove said Indians. This is very temporary. This is not permanent. This isn't land for future generations. But Henry Schoolcraft assures the tribes that it'll never be implemented. He has their back. But what can the tribes do? If they don't sign this thing, the army will likely be sent up to evict them.
So they sign. So then what happened 2 years later?
So they sign the treaty, and under tribal governance, they say we have to ratify this in front of our communities. So bring the treaty back to Michigan in the summer when the ice breaks up, and we want to sign this in front of our communities. And Henry does that, and he brings the treaty to Mackinac Island in July of 1836. And over 4,000 Anishinaabeg go to the island to witness this event that's going to dictate their lives to the present day. And they bring the treaty back, and they sign it. And there is some very strong concern about Article 2. But again, Schoolcraft reassures them that this won't happen under his watch. And 2 years later, in 1838, Schoolcraft is writing our communities telling us it's time for you to pick your lands in Kansas.
Wow. Pack up, huh?
Pack up and go.
Well, what happened?
Well, we didn't go. We
stayed. That's what I was going to say. You're here.
We're here. We knew our rights, and there were some very key individuals who stepped forward for the tribes. They knew what the treaty meant. They knew the language. And they had the leadership behind them to advocate for the tribes' rights under those treaties. And as the wording was in Article 2, the president may, this one word is huge, the president may remove said Indians. And they knew this, that the president never issued this definitive order to remove the Anishinaabeg. But Henry Schoolcraft with pushing it, and we would push back and say, well, where's the president's executive order on this? He never issued it.
A lot of tensions.
Huge tensions. So the five-year provision is up in 1841. The tribes here know this. They're very keen to this. And in 1841, communities within northern Michigan start to send petitions and letters to Congress, to the president, urging him to not remove these communities out west. So they're very proactive. They do what they need to do in order to stay home.
And in the midst of all of this, and it worked because, as you say, we didn't go. You're not in Kansas. In the midst of this, a woman named Agatha Biddle. Who was Agatha, and why was she so important to Native American history on Mackinac Island?
Well, Agatha, she's an interesting character in the fact that her lifetime is basically the span of the 19th century. She sees all of these incredible changes occurring to her people. She lives on Mackinac Island. She's not only witnessing these events like the battles on the island during the War of 1812, the treaty being brought there to be ratified by the communities, but she's also a leader within the Odawa community. She's actually a chief.
Yes, we should note that.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
The Odawa and Ojibwe, they had female chiefs, and they had female leadership coming out of Mackinac, and Agatha was one of the chiefs. And not only was she one of the chiefs of the Mackinac bands, she also ran her own business. So she was an entrepreneur, she was a leader, but she was also very involved in the community. If people needed meals, she would feed them. She would take in kids that needed a home, sort of like an impromptu foster home mm-hmm. within the community.
And Agatha Biddle's house still stands, right? The oldest structure on Mackinac Island, and you're going to turn that to the centerpiece of telling the Native American story on Mackinac.
Yes, so Agatha's house was built approximately 1780. To my knowledge, it's one of the oldest structures in Michigan that's still standing. We've had just an excellent working relationship with the Mackinac State Historic Parks on helping to tell the story of Mackinac from all viewpoints. We worked on a plethora of projects. We did a signage project around Mackinac Island last year with Phil Porter and his staff. He's the executive director at the parks. We've done repatriations of human remains with the parks. So we have a good track record with them, and this just seemed like the next logical step in our work relationship is we need to tell more of the story of the Anishinaabek on the island. It just was a logical choice that we use Agatha in her home and to tell this story through Agatha's lens.
So Agatha's house will be kind of that centerpiece. People can visit that and learn. And then the six markers placed all around the road ringing the island, telling what important things?
Well, the markers, we want to cover as much history as possible, given the space. So there's stories about pre-contact Mackinac. There's, you know, a really rich, deep history that predates the 1600s with the arrival of the French. It goes back thousands of years. And as you go around the island, you're going to see contests for the island. There's all these multiple battles that take place for the island, whether it be Iroquois against Odawa and Ojibwe, American British and Anishinaabek. And you keep going around, and you're going to see signs about the treaty itself. We have one sign just about the treaty era. And then you come back around the island, and we're going to look at some of the more contemporary history of the island, some of the fishing rights that were so prevalent in the 1970s and 80s in the Great Lakes with Native fishermen in the state of Michigan. And we end it with the ancestors that, you know, Mackinac Island has always been a special place because the ancestors were interred there. And they still have a special place for Anishinaabek to this very day with special ceremonies that we hold honoring our ancestors, what we call ghost suppers. So we take it all the way full circle around the island.
Eric, in a nutshell, what do you hope that visitors to Mackinac Island will take away from seeing these markers, thinking about what they represent, and also from being able to eventually visit the Biddle House?
Well, I just hope that they take away, you know, a greater awareness of what Michigan is, who is Michigan in a sense, that it's not just one or two groups, that there's a lot of different people that call Michigan home, but the people that call Michigan home first were the Anishinaabek, and their story is not left in the past. It's brought to the very present day, and that we're still here, and that people, you know, come to recognize that, yeah, you know, this is a special place, and these are all the reasons for that.
Eric Hemingway is with the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians, where he's director of archives and records. Eric, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me back on again.
Still to come, we'll remember the Michigan housewife at the heart of the famous Burning Bed case and the film that woke America up to domestic abuse. Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Her lawyer declared it was probably the worst case of domestic abuse he'd ever seen. And when Francine Hughes of Dansville, Michigan, took the ultimate step to end years of abuse, it changed the way America looked at domestic violence. It was March 9, 1977, when Francine Hughes ended 13 years of abuse from her husband, James, known as Mickey. She waited until he was asleep. She poured gasoline around the bed and lit it. He died. She was charged with first-degree murder and found not guilty because of temporary insanity. Francine's story was told in a TV movie starring Farrah Fawcett, The Burning Bed. It took America by storm. Here's a clip from that 1984 film as Francine's lawyer questions her.
Hey, Francine, let's go through this again. Wait until Mickey fell asleep. Is that right? Right?
Yes.
Then you took the kids out to the car, right? And you got the gasoline out of the garage and you came back into the house, right? And you poured the gasoline around the bed and then you lit a match and ran to the car, right? Right?
Yes.
Okay, the kids were in the car and they were scared and crying and you started driving away. Francine, what were you doing? Where were you going?
I ran for my life. I ran for the life of my kids.
Francine, did you premeditate and plan the death of your husband, Mickey Hughes?
No.
This case also inspired a hit song by country singer Martina McBride, Independence Day. Francine Hughes Wilson died last week at age 69. We're joined now by Barbara Neesmay, who's executive director of Safe House Center in Ann Arbor. Barbara, why was this case such a watershed moment in the fight against domestic violence?
It served as not only a watershed moment, but something to gather around and a case to truly bring to light what was happening in many homes across the United States. The movement to support survivors of domestic violence got started really in the early 70s. And for those of us who remember that time, there weren't cell phones or internet or any real ways for programs to connect with one another and to have a way to say, what are you doing, what's working, what's not working, because it was all so very new. And this was something that they collaborated around and said, yes, this in fact actually happened, and it served as a catalyst for people to see how this can happen and how it can escalate, and it really spurred more programs, more shelters, more volunteerism, more attention to this issue.
Take us back to that day. What was going on in the home?
Well, it was probably for her not any different than what had been happening in the home in the weeks and months leading up to it. One thing we talk about is that survivors often don't do something just out of the blue. It's not like he treated her poorly that day, so that night she decided to kill him. This is after years of abuse and years of promises. And it's ironic, there's a TV show on HBO that just wrapped up called Big Little Lies that takes an interesting twist on this issue as well. But back to Francine Hughes, what happened that day is that she resolved that she wasn't going to tolerate this anymore. She had turned to family for help. She had turned to friends for help. There weren't programs like Safe House. She really felt like she had nowhere else to go. And the only way she was going to survive and to take care of her kids is if he died. And what's interesting is that studies have been done after the shelters were opened in the 70s and the 80s, and what happened is that fewer assailants died because the shelters opened.
And when you stop and you realize that just, as you say, after 13 years of mental and physical abuse, and on that day he beat her, wouldn't let her make dinner for their kids. He ripped up the textbooks from her secretarial classes and demanded she burn them. She made dinner for the children while the beating resumed, and he threw the food on the floor and rubbed her face in the mess.
Yep.
And they show that in The Burning Bed very graphically. And it is stomach-churning to think. But as you say, this is going on in households everywhere. But that's a fascinating point that there are fewer deaths of assailants because there is a safety valve.
Mm-hmm.
For these survivors.
Yeah, and what had happened is that all she wanted to do was leave. That was a common theme. She wanted to be able to work. She wanted to be able to just take care of her kids. She sought help from family. She loved him, but she knew that she could not stay with him or she would die.
And I know she called police that day, but because of the way the law was at the time, am I right? If they didn't see something happen, they couldn't do anything. So laws have been changed.
Yes, laws have been changed. A lot has changed, actually, since that movie. I'm thinking about it. Oh, my golly. It's a long time. And what has changed is that, well, first of all, what happens between a husband and wife is private. And that started to abate a bit in the late 70s, early 80s. But then it turned into, well, they didn't see it. They couldn't do anything about it. And it was a he said, she said. Now that has stepped back quite a bit because now they're saying, if there is a report of any physical threat or harm, then they can take a report and move on it. So how the police respond has changed, and then the laws have changed as well, because it used to be that you couldn't testify against your spouse. Well, that's not the case anymore.
Now, she was celebrated as a feminist heroine, but she really had enough of the limelight. So what was Francine's life like after she was acquitted?
Oh, gosh. She got a lot of attention that I don't think she necessarily thought she would get. It really was not a fan of the limelight, and she just wanted to raise her kids and do her thing. And she did express a little bit of frustration late in later years that it had to be temporary insanity. Why couldn't it have been she just was defending herself and her children? And that was the only way she knew how. But back then, that kind of case logic was just not going to work. She definitely believed in and supported survivors. It's hard to think of her past tense, but she also said, you know, I just need to live my life. So.
And she did remarry.
Yes.
Yes.
It's possible. I mean, if people think that survivors think that they hate men, that's not true at all. They don't like people who abuse other people. Mm-hmm. I think we can all agree with that.
Francine Hughes Wilson died last week at age 69. Ever find yourself wondering how many lives have been saved because of the changes that came from the Burning Bad case?
I refer to that film as landmark and encourage everybody to see it because I don't think people understand from where it is that we came, but still how far we have to go because there are still some things in that film that exist today. There are still some attitudes and beliefs from people in helping professions that don't understand the dynamics of domestic violence, and we're still trying to educate them to the ends of this is not their fault. And there are many survivors who are caught in economic abuse cycles because they just can't. The thought of leaving and not having a job and not having what they need is overwhelming, and shelters are full. So It's still very challenging, but we have come a very long way. And we owe a great debt of gratitude to Francine for her willingness to be brave and to really push this case through and to stay strong. That had to have been so hard.
Barbara Niesmay, Executive Director of Safe House Center in Ann Arbor. And you can find out more information about their work by going to their website, safehousecenter.org. Barbara, thanks so much.
Thank you for your time today.
Try to imagine how it would feel to be accused of a crime, wrongfully accused. You didn't do it, but you're convicted and you're sent to prison. Then, miraculously, you get another shot and your innocence is proven. You're released with absolutely no compensation, no help reentering the world outside prison walls. That was the case in our state until just last week when Public Act 343 took effect. It provides exonerees with compensation for time served. David Moran is co-founder of the Innocence Clinic at the University of Michigan, where he's a clinical professor of law. David, what is in this brand new law?
It's like a lot of other states' compensation laws in that it provides a flat amount of money for each year of wrongful incarceration in a state prison for people who have had their convictions overturned because of new evidence of actual innocence and who can then go to court, in this case, the Court of Claims in Lansing, and establish their innocence.
How much do they get?
$50,000 per year.
You know, it is interesting when you think about sitting in prison for any amount of time, and it's hard to put a price tag on it, but when you stop and you realize that parolees in Michigan were getting a helping hand all this time, why did it take Michigan so long to realize that the people who were wrongfully convicted deserved even a bigger helping hand?
You know, I don't know. The bill was something that Senator Steve Bita, formerly Representative Steve Bita, worked on for years. And he introduced it in every session for, I think, 8 consecutive years. And some years it passed one house, some years it passed the other house. It consistently passed committees, but somehow it just always managed to lose traction until this year we finally got it done.
What kind of arguments were made against it through all of these years of trying to push it through?
Well, we heard arguments about how anybody who gets their conviction overturned for any reason is going to go and try and collect the money. But the bill was written from the get-go to be limited to people who could prove actual innocence, not just that their conviction was overturned for any reason. Mm-hmm. We heard claims that people would try and coerce people to come forward to prove their innocence in order to get the money, to which we said, well, actually, you would have the same incentive to do that, to overturn the conviction. People aren't going to try and get out of prison and get the money. They're going to try and get out of prison in order to get out of prison. And so we thought some of the arguments we heard against it we thought were pretty silly. And eventually the opposition just folded.
Now, I think a lot of people don't realize how often it can happen that somebody is wrongfully convicted, is sent away. And so how many people have been exonerated in Michigan?
The National Registry of Exonerations, which anyone can look up, just Google National Registry of Exonerations, has about 2,000 people have been exonerated nationally, including 69 in Michigan since 1990.
So just to kind of focus our attention on who is eligible for compensation, because I know that there are some pretty strict guidelines.
Right. So you have to have been in a Michigan prison. So being convicted and not sent to prison does not make you eligible. You have to have had the conviction overturned because of new evidence that wasn't presented at trial. And then you have to go to the Michigan Court of Claims in Lansing and file a claim that will convince them by clear and convincing evidence that you are in fact innocent. In addition, you're not eligible for compensation if you were in prison for another crime for which you weren't exonerated. So, for example, if you were sent to prison for 4 or 5 crimes and you only turn out to be innocent of one of them, then you're not going to be eligible for compensation because you would have been in prison anyway. If you won a lawsuit, then you're not eligible for compensation, or at least you're not eligible to double dip for the same amount of money. So, for example, if you served 10 years in prison and you won a lawsuit against the police because you were wrongfully convicted by police misconduct and you collected $300,000 from the police, then you'd only be eligible to get $200,000 from the compensation fund. If you, on the other hand, you won more than $500,000 in a lawsuit, then you wouldn't be eligible at all. So the idea of the compensation is to compensate people who can't win lawsuits. And that's really important because the way our civil litigation system is set up, you can't sue the judge. You almost never can sue the prosecutor. It's effectively impossible in Michigan to sue the defense attorney who may have screwed up and resulted in your wrongful conviction. You can't sue the witnesses who lied against you because they have something called testimonial immunity. So the only people you can sue are the police, and only then if you can establish that they violated clearly established constitutional norms in their conduct that led to your wrongful conviction. So the vast majority of people who've been wrongfully convicted actually can't successfully sue, and so this compensation fund is for them.
When you think of the clients that you've represented, the exonerees, who now that this law has been signed, this could really mean something for them. What are you hearing from them, and what do you think they would do with the compensation money?
Well, they would just try and put their lives back together. I mean, $50,000 per year is not that much. I often speak about this subject in front of all sorts of organizations in Michigan, and I say, would any of you take $50,000 to be wrongfully convicted for 1 year, have your reputation destroyed, your family destroyed, lose your job, your livelihood? And of course, no one says no. But it's something, and it allows them to maybe put their lives back together, maybe get an education that was missed because they spent those years in prison, maybe get a place to live, a house. Give them some cushion so that they can start putting their lives back together.
I've got to imagine some of these people have absolutely lost the best earning years of their lives.
Right. Devontae Sanford, for example, who was exonerated last year, was 14 when he was arrested and he was 24 when he came out. Now, how do you replace those years? So assuming he's compensated or he wins a lawsuit, he does have a mm-hmm. potential of a lawsuit, he would presumably use that money to help with his education, and putting his life back together. But David Gavitt, one of our exonerees, was 27 when he went to prison, and he was 54 when he got out. And he was working a factory job. He was working at Steelcase in Grand Rapids when he was wrongfully convicted. And he's been able to land factory jobs since then. But that's 27 years of earnings that he didn't make.
Is this tax-free?
Yes. By act of Congress, state compensation awards are federally tax-free. And the legislature made this tax-free as well. In a separate piece of legislation, they made this compensation award tax-free. In addition, there are attorney's fees for the attorneys who go to the Court of Claims and litigate these.
So Michigan now becomes the 32nd state to have some kind of compensation for those who are wrongfully convicted. How does this law in Michigan compare to, you know, the other 30-plus states?
It's about average. Okay. People are always surprised when I tell them that the Rolls-Royce of state compensation laws is Texas. Texas has an extremely generous compensation law that provides $80,000 per year plus a large annuity up front with a formula for that, plus all sorts of other things added into it. For example, free dental and medical care, free tuition at Texas universities, and a host of other things. Now, I should add that at the same time SB 291 was enacted and signed by the governor in December of this year, a companion bill was also signed by the governor that makes future exonerees eligible to get the same benefits that parolees get. That was one of the complaints that we always had, is that we would walk somebody out the door and they would get literally nothing from the Department of Corrections, whereas somebody who was finished their term and was paroled got certain benefits, which is great. We really want parolees to get these benefits because it reduces the chances of them reoffending. But it just made sense to everyone that exonerees should get these same benefits. So help with getting their documents together, help with finding jobs, housing, help signing up for health care. So all the benefits that a parolee gets to help get them back on their feet so they won't reoffend, future exonerees in Michigan will be eligible to get those same benefits.
Are you happy with what Michigan now has?
It's not perfect, but I'm happy.
What would you like to see?
Well, I would have liked to have seen more money per year, and I would have liked to have seen some of the eligibility standards loosened a little bit. But overall, I think Governor Snyder and the legislature passed a very good bill.
David Moran, co-founder of the Innocence Clinic at the University of Michigan. I want to thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And join us every Monday of this month. You'll hear stories from Michiganders who are eligible for this new compensation. Next week, we'll hear from Julie Baumer. She served 4 years in prison for an erroneous child abuse conviction.
It was devastating. I knew that it was going to be a collapse in my life, with a ripple effect going everywhere in every dynamic part of my life, personal and professional.
That's next Monday in our series looking at exonerated Michiganders. That's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.